This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Welcome right here, right now, Paul Brizard and Simon Reeve.
Morning, hello.
You're this side.
I'm this side?
You're that side. That's what they told me.
Okay.
Good heavens.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. How many of you were here this time last year? Very nice to see you all again. You will remember that Simon and I were talking about Greece.
Hello.
How many of you then went on to see the show and enjoyed it? A few hands.
About four.
About four, exactly.
That's okay.
We're here.
They've got better things to do.
Today. Can we hear Simon all right? Can you hear?
Hopefully, yes.
Can you hear Simon at the back?
Don't pull your microphone off, Simon. Yes, there we are. Okay. All right.
This time last year we were talking about Greece. This year, you've been to Turkey.
I have, yes.
There's a show for Turkey about to come out. Turkey?
Yeah, it'll be a couple more months, I think. So, yes, I've been filming in Turkey. Made a couple of programmes about Turkey. It will be called Turkey. And goodness me, yes, I mean, I feel very blessed to do what I do because it was another fantastic journey by Spin. So we started... is that going to ruin the microphone? No.
You're
so we've basically gone a huge circle around Turkey. I'm doing the touristy bit down here, the Turquoise Coast, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. Turquoise Coast, which of course, as you all know, was Mark Antony's gift to Cleopatra, I believe. That was his main wedding gift.
Exactly.
Such is the beauty of that area.
Such was the beauty of her. Nice wedding gift as well.
To give not bad.
Out of the country. Greece, you were really brilliant about finding some undiscovered parts of Greece. I remember an incredibly deep valley, crazy monks driving tractors with guns, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
What were you expecting from Turkey? Because, of course, it's been much in the news the last 5-6 years, usually for bad reasons.
That is why lots of places often make the news, isn't it? We only hear about them when something goes wrong or something is perceived to have gone wrong. I think we set out to try and find some interesting characters there. There was one guy I loved in particular who I want to send you all to stay with. He's got a B&B in the Black Sea Mountains of Turkey. And the only sort of small catch is that his bed and breakfast is the other side of a valley from where your vehicle can get to. And he has rigged up a homemade... half-kilometre-long zip wire which goes across a valley with a drop of 400 metres down to trees that look like matchsticks far below. And he created this sort of crate to go across the zip wire that was tested with the weight of a cow. So if it can hold a cow, it can definitely hold one or two of us and our baggage, I'm confident. And he was a wonderful character, so... Yes, he's probably my standout favourite person in the show because his whole idea is that actually we don't need roads. We can create other means of getting around. We don't need to sort of have huge expanses of tarmac through a pristine part of the planet like the Black Sea. And he's just a magnificent character who's a sort of wild woodsman with an enormous dog that I sort of slightly fell in love with. A dog the size of which I have rarely seen anywhere else. It's called a Kangol. Has anyone heard of a Kangol dog? It's a sort of Turkish shepherd dog, mountain dog, bred for fighting off bears. So it is utterly enormous, but a completely soppy creature as well. Anyway, we'll put the details in the programme, and I expect a commission from booking.com for the B&B.
So, did you say half a mile or half a kilometre?
Half a kilometre.
How long does that take when you're on it?
Well, you're screaming most of the time, so it goes quite quickly.
You scream and then you run out of oxygen and you just pass out. Talk to me. There was something I'd learned from reading about this show, about something I'd not heard about called halal tourism. Can you talk
right.
to me about
that? Yeah, it's a bit of a new phenomenon where... hotels are being certified as halal friendly, and there are several dozens of hotels along the Turkish coast are appealing to the Gulf tourist market, but also European Muslims as well. And so they're doing things like they're converting hotels that were receiving lobster-coloured Russian tourists, lobster-coloured Brits as well, lobster-coloured German tourists, and they've switched and converted the hotels into halal-friendly hotels. Generally involves taking pork off the menu and obviously not serving alcohol.
Right.
Some of the swimming pools have been slightly segregated, and they're appealing to a completely new market. And it's very interesting because obviously Turkey's historical... Is this falling off my ear?
I
always have a problem with ear-related... There we go. Ear-related things. I don't know what I'm talking about. Anyway, so what's particularly interesting is I think Turkey's historic position obviously has been crossroads and connection between East and West. And for so long, everybody has said Turkey needs to make a choice. Is it a Western country that looks to Europe, or is it an Eastern country that looks to the Middle East and Asia? And people have claimed that Turkey needed to make a decision one way or the other. And the sense I have, having been there now, and I'm still writing the script for the program, so I'm not entirely sure this will be the conclusion, but I do feel that Turkey has decided to say, look, we're not going to make your choice. We're not going to choose one or the other. We're going to choose our own path. We're going to take the bits that we want when we want them, and we're going to adapt and come up with our own new system. And in some ways, that system is slightly contradictory, or even against fundamental sort of European values. I mean,
sure,
they're going for a political system that's almost democratic authoritarianism. But in terms of faith and religion, they're trying to find a path between radically different cultures, of course, and taking the best of both. And making money from both as well, I think.
Well, this does have ramifications in some of the industries. You do a piece about the wine industry in Turkey, which has hitherto been rather flourishing, and is having a bit of a tough time now. Is that right?
Yes. Thank you for knowing this. Yes. So we start the programmes in the far west of Turkey, so on the sort of European side of Turkey. And, yeah, it's quite surprising to find an area with dozens of vineyards in a country that is almost entirely Muslim. So...
Right.
They think Turkey might have even been the birthplace for winemaking. And we go to a vineyard. Obviously, I helped doing cutting a few of the grapes and nearly take a couple of people's fingers off. And we learn from the owner of the vineyard, who gave up a job in IT so he could live his dream of producing quality wines, that it was going very well. And then the government, President Erdogan's government, imposed restrictions on wine. Wine has become a bit of a battleground in Turkey between the secular Turks, who are a minority but have traditionally controlled the country, and the more pious religious majority, who for the first time really now are in power.
Quite.
And restrictions have been put on tastings of wine, promotions of wines and advertising of wine, and obviously that's hammering the Turkish wine industry, which was really starting to make a name for itself internationally.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of people here are obviously here today trying to figure out where they're going to go for their summer holidays this year. What would you recommend about Turkey? Would you recommend as a place to go? Would you recommend people going to the south coast, as you say, the fantastic southern part, or to travel further afield?
No,
are there risks? Is it fine? Is it safe? Talk us through it.
I would completely recommend Turkey. I think it's a fascinating place. It's beautiful. It's got a strong tourist industry, as you know, and the tourist industry there has taken something of a hammering in recent years. If you've been before, you should go again, because they need visitors now more than ever. This isn't a country where a few people benefit slightly from tourism. It's a country where millions and millions utterly depend on it. So I think for love, kinship, friendship, etc., tourism is a very, very powerful force for good, as I'm sure we're all pretty aware. And yeah, I think certainly people have been put off from visiting Turkey, I think because of the terrorist attacks that have happened there, because of the political situation there with the failed coup last year, and because of the proximity to Syria. Now, I was to sort of deal with those one by one. Yes, there have been terrorist attacks there, but as we know, there have been terrorist attacks in France and much closer to home as well. We cannot live our life on our knees. You know, there are large areas of the world where, if you listen to the media, obviously you will be told that there are great risks. But in reality, the great realization, if you like, for me, since I started traveling extensively, is just how safe and welcoming planet Earth is. Second point, I think, was about the government. If you're traveling as a tourist, you're not really going to experience anything of the political situation there. There is a crisis there. There is a purge underway where the government is trying to remove its opposition and it's trying to remove members of the organisation that they think is behind the coup. There are enormous human rights issues about that. I would not deny that. But I think as a tourist, you can still go and have a holiday adventure and experience there, not be affected by it, but learn about that as well. Don't be afraid to ask questions of people about this and to inquire. You can ask almost anything of anyone if you ask politely, I think. Third point is proximity to Syria. Yes, that shares a border with Syria. And goodness me, that is, as we know, one of the most benighted parts of the planet now. You will really not experience that conflict unless you're right there. That was the great surprise to me, really, was traveling around the country. And we landed there just after the failed coup had happened. We were planning to go before it. We carried on and were allowed to still visit. We saw very little evidence of a security infrastructure, if you like, or tension resulting from either the coup or the crisis next door in Syria. I was right on the border with Syria. I was in a refugee camp on the border where the edge of the camp is the border with Syria. It's got the hairs on my arm going up thinking about it, because I could hear in the distance the thump of artillery hitting Aleppo. We were that close, and it was a terrifying, hideous sound, and people in the camp were recoiling with each explosion. But on the Turkish side, there was a sort of frightening normality almost. It shows you just how a line, an almost arbitrary line, can divide madness and order. I was standing on a hill just outside the camp, and we were watching Katyusha rocket fire almost. That's sort of Stalin's organs, if you've seen pictures, firing off into the dust sky. And it was hideous. And then at the same time, just down below, I could see farmers ploughing their fields. And it was that contradiction and sort of obscenity of madness and normality at the same time. But that is life on our planet. So you can go, you can have a normal experience. Don't shy away, wherever you are, don't shy away from the problems. Don't shy away from asking questions and feeling embarrassed or worried about that. Because people always, in my experience anyway, people always want to talk. And you'll soon realise, you know, the rare occasions they don't.
It's the third time you've done the Stanford's Travel Writer Show. I know it's probably about the 23rd time you've been here to destinations. You've shot, 80 to 90 shows now. You've been to... There must be fewer countries that you haven't been to than those that you have. Mm. You still have the zest for travel. It's a bit of a weird question to ask you, but what does it still teach you? What do you still learn from travelling?
I don't think it is a weird question. I think it's a very fair one. At some point, people might say, well, haven't you done enough? You know, you've seen quite a lot. And I have been incredibly blessed with the journeys I've done. I feel very, very privileged. You know, I grew up not far from here. I didn't get on a plane until I started working. I don't come from a travel-y, wealthy family. Travel isn't normal for me. It's still an experience.
Right.
I think what I get from it is completely different experiences every time. But that's the joy, really. It's partly because I'm a bit of a goldfish with a memory like I'm lacking memory cells. So each experience feels very new and fresh to me. But I think, yes, there are more countries I've been to than I haven't now, and that feels more extraordinary to no one other than me, or no one more than me. But it's a bit of a misnomer, really, to imagine you can go to Brazil once and then have done Brazil.
Exactly.
There are 7 billion stories, individual human stories on this planet, and each of them is special and unique and generally fascinating. So I am never bored listening and talking to people about their tales. And I remember a lot of the time when I'm talking to people, I haven't really got a clue what they're saying, because they're chatting away to me in Spanish, let's say, in Colombia. And I'm standing there going, nodding away and trying to work out what they're saying and watching their body language and thinking about the scene around and am I standing in the right position for the camera and have I got the appropriate face for what I think the story is they're telling me, because there's sometimes I've thought, oh, this is a jolly story, I'll smile, and then I
my
discover
my mother has died, my
exactly,
children are in prison.
My village was raised to the ground, and then that's when the translation comes in and I mean, oh, sad face, and it is a little bit, that can be a little bit embarrassing, but honestly, I think the interaction you can still have with people, despite being a Muppet like me who speaks no other language, is still strong and profound, but of course a translator helps. So I think ultimately what I'm saying is there are few finer experiences to be had on this planet than travelling around this extraordinary world, and we're all very, very blessed to be doing it. So while you are still willing to have me on the screen, I would consider it an honour and a privilege.
We'll come to how the BBC funds it shortly. There's something I've noticed about a lot of the trips that you've done. They seem to involve sunshine and warmth and azure blue seas. Until I saw Arctic Live, which struck me as being a bit of a departure from your new normal sort of destination. Could you tell us how the concept of Arctic Live came about and what it was and what you did?
Yes. So I was one of three telly presenters who made a series last year called Arctic Live, just in case you've got better things to do than watch the telly all the time. And the idea was that we would broadcast live, as we did. We completed the mission relatively successfully, I think. So we broadcast live from Churchill in northern Canada, which genuinely is the polar bear capital of the world, as polar bears were migrating effectively through this small town on their way to Hudson Bay, which freezes over, and then the bears can head out and hunt seals to their heart's content. So I know who it was. It was Sarah, who was the series producer, came up with this quite mad and technically very, very difficult idea that we would transport an entire BBC team to the frozen wastes of northern Canada and then broadcast live to the United Kingdom. And although the BBC obviously likes to do things like push the envelope, I think they call it, and blue sky, blah, 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 thinking, etc., one of the reasons this was a massive challenge was because what they decided to do was not just feed our signal back to the UK, but they decided basically that just before the programme went live, somebody would flick a switch in London and everything, including the editing, the programme control and so on, would come from Churchill in Canada.
Oh, wow.
So we had to sort of occupy part of a community centre, and for all those who worry about how the BBC spends its money, we had editing suites set up literally in the men's hockey room's showers, and they had bits of equipment I've got pictures of perched on the urinals in the toilets, and these poor guys, the editing team, working out of these next to these sweaty lockers, and part of the editing suite was set up in the bowling alley of this community centre. Anyway, that's the sort of behind the scenes palaver. In front of it, we just had to look calm on the surface while technical chaos reigned around. And we managed to broadcast live. We also had some pre-shot videos that we fed into the programme. So I had the distinct honour of going to Greenland. Look at it up there. It is almost as big as that. Goodness me. And Greenland, I went to northern Russia and northern Norway as well. Yeah, I have been very lucky in that my gig has been the warmer parts of the world. But this was a very special experience for me. And
why? What made it so special?
Well, it's the frozen north of our world. I hadn't really visited there. The people, the stories, the place are all majestic and epic up there. Everything is massive and vital and ignored in many ways. And I think Greenland made as much of an impression on me as anywhere I've been to recently. You know, it's vast, of course we do, and we hear about this ice sheet that covers it. And I think it's very badly named because it's not really an ice sheet. It is a colossal block of ice, more than on average, more than a kilometre thick and deep. And if it melts, obviously chaos and rains for the rest of us, it will melt what we're doing to our planet, no doubt about it. But flying around Greenland in a helicopter with the ice patrol who monitor icebergs, because that's where the one that sank the Titanic is thought to come from, so they keep an eye on them. I was just really confronted by a sight on a scale that you cannot imagine until you actually see it. The place is so big that, genuinely, it's an overused phrase in my profession, but to really get a sense of how big it is, you need to be up in the air. And then you're confronted by something that has been there since the dawn of our species, and if it melts, will put a lot of us underwater, and you realise, right, oh my God, this is the power and potential of our planet. So that was why it was very special. Broadcasting live as well was a... was an experience, I would say. That's my first gig doing that. So
is
the
that,
cold
yes,
and live.
First live. That's a tough one.
Yeah, I've done things where I've talked on camera on BBC Breakfast,
sure,
and things like that.
On a whole show.
But there, you're just, you know, you're answering the questions is much easier, as I'm sure you're aware, than actually asking them and helming the situation. So in this Arctic Live project, I was the one who had to talk and be the face of the show. And it was only a couple of hours before we started to go live that they sort of revealed to me that Gordon Buchanan and Kate Humble, who are much more experienced and much more professional, they were on slightly more remote tundra buggies out on the ice, and I was the person in the town. So there was a distinct possibility that the live feed would fail from the two tundra buggies, and then it would be all on me to chat away to you all live from the middle of nowhere with not much going on in my brain. And that honestly was one of the deep breath moments of my life. It's quite an experience, actually. I mean, I've been very blessed on the journeys I've done, but when you've got a voice in your ear telling you in soft, soothing Scottish tones, 2 minutes to live, get ready, be prepared, 60 seconds, and you hear the sort of slight panic from everybody else as a camera fails, the sound boom falls, blah, 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 10 seconds, get ready, don't panic, and they weren't like that, they were very calm. I was the one going, okay, I needed something to grip onto, actually, that was a stabilising feeling.
It helps. Can we talk a little bit about how it is working for the BBC? You've talked in the past about how budgets are so tightly controlled and you have to sort of book out the equipment that you have to take and then you have to give your sweaty socks back to the BBC.
That's quite a memory you've got.
And I think we had a joke about you may have used Michael Palin's socks at some stage, who is, of course, appearing here later on today.
I imagine Michael gets his own socks.
I would imagine he does these days. But when you mentioned the zip wire at the top of this conversation, a sudden thought went through my head, and I've seen these forms that you have to fill in for BBC health and safety requirements.
Yeah.
How did that work?
Yes, interesting, yes. it's a tricky thing. Risk assessments.
Risk assessment, that's it.
I am very lucky in that I do not have to get involved in that at all. So that's definitely the producer, director-producer's job. The BBC is conscious of it. I think probably appropriately so. They're very keen to point out they are not risk-averse.
Right.
As shown by the fact I was allowed to go on the zip wire and, in fact, was the first one of our team to do it. Nobody travelled it first.
Oh, really?
Let's send the expendable assistant producer. No, I did it first, and that's important for me, but it's also the BBC's willing for that.
Right.
Rightly so. But, yes, there are checks, and people do have to fill in very long forms identifying what they think the risks are. And I think it's appropriate. The BBC gets not just pilloried, but prosecuted when things go wrong. And the BBC is held up as being the sort of benchmark for, not health and safety, because that now has such negative connotations, but they've got to take risks, but they've got to do it sensibly. And I think I'm really proud of the risk we are allowed to take. And you saw in the showreel there, I've been into some very tricky situations, and the BBC hasn't stopped that. I wouldn't say it's encouraged, but it's allowed.
Even in Mogadishu, when you're taking a wrong turn, and the guys with you are having to cock their weapons just in case?
Yeah, all right. That was a story I just told you when you said you were writing something about getting lost, and I happened to mention it. I don't think I would want the BBC to know that what we plan for, there's some military terms about No plan survives direct contact with the enemy. And often it does feel like that. As much as we prepare and we fill in the risk assessment for what could possibly go wrong on this journey, then yes, your armoured personnel carrier, thank you, Paul, takes a wrong turn in Mogadishu and you are suddenly going through enemy territory and the Ugandan soldier with you says, get ready to grab that AK-47, and he's not mucking about. So then, yes, your promises to the BBC about never picking up a weapon go out of the window because you're in a situation where you have to adapt. They do have this phrase I do love. It's called a dynamic risk assessment. Have you heard of that as well? Where basically we're given a degree of autonomy, so we can decide. On the spot, is this risky, too risky, or is this okay? And, you know, I have a sort of rule in the small teams I work in. If anybody wants us to withdraw, then we go into reverse. And generally, I'm the bloke on sort of point in the sense that everybody else is focusing on their very specific tasks, like Jonathan or Craig, the incredible cameramen I've generally worked with. They're just looking through a tiny little hole like this, and they've normally got the other eye closed. So it's up to me. I'm standing in front of them looking at everything. If I say we're going, then I have to sort of pull them with me because they're so keen to film. But yeah, the risk assessments are part of the gig, part of the job. Assessing risk fundamentally is part of the job. With the zip wire, we had long conversations, or they had long conversations with the owner about how he built it, how he tested it. As much as anything, you assess the person as you do the situation. Yes, so do we trust this guy? Is he calm, sensible, and not mad? And yes, all boxes were correctly ticked.
Dynamic risk assessment and situational appropriateness.
Yeah, I've never heard that phrase. I'm relieved to hear.
It's, yeah. It'll come. You've just come back from Colombia. Are you at liberty to tell us what you've been doing there?
I think so. Complete liberty.
What were you doing in Colombia?
These folk kindly pay for it. So I was filming a programme about Colombia for the BBC. It's just a one-off programme. Slightly more, I suppose, political than a sort of more glorious journey like Turkey. But that's not to say, and I'm smiling as I'm saying that, because Colombia is absolutely... gobsmacking is a word I overuse as well, but it is absolutely gorgeous. It really is. And the reason for going to Colombia is, of course, there's a peace process underway there. They've signed, or they had signed, a peace deal last year, ending decades of conflict and suffering, epic suffering. More than 200,000 people killed, 7 million people displaced within the country, more refugees than anywhere else in the Western Hemisphere. And the peace deal between the government and the FARC, rebels, guerrillas, terrorists, was finally signed last year. Much applause. 2,500 statespeople from around the world turned up to witness the signing. And the agreement was signed by the president and the leader of the FARC group with a pen made from an old bullet, all hugely symbolic. And then they put this peace deal to the people in a popular vote, and in a sort of Brexit type shocker, the Colombians rejected it and by a tiny margin said no to the peace deal. So we went there to try and find out whether peace is possible and whether it will actually happen. And went on a long journey around the country, had one or two adventures, as is our way in TV, ended up in one of the last FARC guerrilla camps in the middle of the jungle with one of the leaders of FARC. What else did we do? Goodness, we had quite an experience. We went to an illegal gold mine raid with the Colombian army that nearly ended in sort of disaster as we were all blown by helicopters into barbed wire. Incredibly hot, incredibly sweaty experience generally. Gold mining. Did any of you know illegal gold mining in South America now earns criminal gangs more money than they get from drug trafficking? Quite extraordinary. Thousands and thousands and thousands of illegal gold mines causing incredible damage to the environment. So the Colombian army is trying to shut them down. And we had a very dramatic situation where we went to this gold mine and they blew up the diggers that were responsible for the gold mining. So anyway, I'll be on the telly at some point and hopefully the programme will make more sense than I am now, because I've only just got back, so I'm still processing the experiences, quite frankly. But lots of incredible characters. I've rarely met a Colombian who hasn't been affected by the conflict in some way, because it has gone on for decades and every part of the country has been touched. So fingers and toes crossed for them and their country that they can finally find peace. I really am quite hopeful. Can I tell you one more thing about it? Because no, okay.
The more you talk, the fewer questions they get to ask.
Fair point.
Of course you can, but can it be short?
Sort of. Please. Yeah, no, I had a very special moment, which makes me a little lump in the throat moment. Oh. We went to a posh restaurant in Medellin to film the chef there talking about his foundation, which is working, cooking for peace, basically. He has been helping to rehabilitate FARC guerrillas, ex-soldiers who've been injured in the conflict, and former paramilitaries. And we filmed in his kitchen a really wonderful moment where three of his kitchen staff were chatting away with us, and they were a former FARC guerrilla, a soldier who'd lost an eye and a leg to a landmine, and a former member of the right-wing paramilitary death squads. And they're all standing there chatting to us. They'd all been victims as well as oppressors in the conflict. And we realised they were standing there and they had their arms all sort of around each other while they were talking to us. And it was just such a beautiful moment where former enemies come together. It does make you think there can be peace anywhere.
Are you slightly trailing a Simon Reeve Cookery Around the World programme?
We have joked about the elements it would need to make the sort of perfect BBC Two programme. And of course that would involve baking, travel, sewing. Obviously it would have to involve Stephen Fry in some form, even if he was just narrating it, etc. But yeah, I think they've tried it. Cooking, chatting and quizzing in the danger zone, that sort of thing.
Simon Reeve and Mary Berry, cakes around the world. Start lobby now.
Right. I think Mary would be up for it, you know. I really do.
Would. Yeah. I think she would. And you don't look like you eat much cake, it has to be said. You could probably get some cake on.
No, there. I've been very lucky. But I was on, I don't know why I'm saying this, but I know Mary. Mary Berry's a good laugh. I've just met her once, but when they were scraping the barrel, I was one of the sort of Z-list people on Celebrity Comic Relief Bake Off. And my secret weapon on that, which was completely excluded from the edit, was I claimed that I needed a bottle of whiskey for my cake that I was baking, and I kept giving Mary Berry nips of whiskey, and honestly, she was asking for another tot in the nicest way. I'm not slandering at all, I hope.
Before we verge into danger,
she's game for the show.
Let's not go into dangerous territory about Mary Berry and whiskey. Right, questions for you guys. We've got 10-ish minutes. If you'd like to ask questions for Simon, okay. We have a lovely man called Roddy with a microphone who will come to you.
Or will attempt to.
Or will attempt to. You've done well.
Without treading on anybody. Thank you.
Lisa.
What advice would you give to people wanting to break into travel documentaries?
I'm not going to give any advice to anybody wanting to. I quite like my job. Why on earth would I help somebody else? It's a good time to do it, because obviously there is a proliferation of channels out there. I think it's a risky thing to try and specifically get into, because obviously, in reality, there are few paid gigs, quite frankly. But for travel as a career, I think there's a huge amount of possibilities. And now, obviously, more than ever. I mean, the travel opportunities that are available to us here and now, but also to youngsters coming up, are experiences that our ancestors could only have begun to imagine. I mean, the things we can do now are extraordinary. So if you're really saying about documentaries, obviously film some stuff and put it on YouTube, work for independent production companies and have great ideas. But I would say don't hope too much, because generally the telly people who are out there have done something else first and then got the calling through a different way. I mean, one popular route seems to be go into the army, be in the army for a bit, then become a tour leader.
He's over there signing his book.
Then become a tour leader working on big expedition tours and work alongside a TV crew and really impress them with your charm and wit. And then they say, oh, this person will make a good TV character. And that has been how it has for several people. I wrote books. That's my background. That's how I got onto telly. So writing books is also a good idea, I'd say.
Yeah, go somewhere interesting, write about it, send it as an article to any travel editor of any newspaper, and then build that up to getting a publishing deal. It's a tried and tested way. We haven't looked over here much. Could there be any questions from over here for Simon? Nope.
You don't have to. It's not...
If you can make it, it's a lady in blue and white at the back.
So you could just chuck the microphone.
Just pass the microphone. Get the crowd to help. They're
surf
a friendly
it.
Lot. Thank you.
Okay. Hello.
Hello.
I was watching a repeat of your visit to Madagascar the other day.
Right.
And
thank
your
you.
Concerns about the environment and wildlife. Which country are you most concerned about in that respect?
Ooh, that's a really interesting... I haven't been asked that before. It's a lovely question. It makes me think.
In terms
I mean,
of
for different reasons, yeah. In terms of what's being lost... the biggest area of forest loss is in Russia. Indonesia, of course, has been hammered because it's extraordinary and spread over lots of remote islands. Madagascar, in many ways, is one of the most troubling because what we're losing there is unique and special. Madagascar is like the Galapagos, but on a much bigger scale, you know, in the sense that life has been cut off there for an age and it's evolved in special and spectacular ways. When humans first arrived on Madagascar, there were lemurs there the size of gorillas. So we have wiped out very, very special and spectacular creatures there already, and now we're losing forests on an epic scale. But I'd also be very worried about not just the countries where biodiversity is being lost, but countries that will feel the consequences most directly. So the country that leaps screaming into my head when you say that is Bangladesh, actually, which is poor and is packed and is very, very special and is one of my favourite countries and people as well, frankly, in the world. And Bangladesh and Bangladeshis will be absolutely hammered by our changing world. We will be more insulated from that than the temperate zone, but one of the things that's happening to me endlessly now as on my travels is I go to remote parts of the world, lucky as I am to do that, and I meet indigenous people and indigenous leaders who are saying to me, look, we know our world is changing. Insects are flying in areas they haven't before. Ice caps are melting. Rivers are not running when they should. We can't farm and forest the way we used to. They know their world is changing, and they're not, you know, reading magazines online or anything like that. So it's definitely happening. We are seeing our planet changing in dramatic ways. We can make a difference on our journeys by going to these special national parks and marine protected areas and paying our entrance fees and helping to keep those places down. Because if we don't, they will be logged and destroyed. So that's something vital that we must do. And I know you all do that because you're adventurous travellers, but you really must force, blackmail and bribe others to do it as well. Get off their behinds, get away from the swimming pool and get out and have proper experiences when they're on holidays. Thank you for the question. Sorry, I'm trying to do it as quickly as I could.
Not at all. I remember you saying this last year that actually the money you pay to get into the game reserve or the wildlife park goes straight into the tanks of, you know, the petrol tanks of the Land Rovers, Land Cruisers that are protecting the very animals that you have come there to see.
Yeah, if we don't go. Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Next question. Over there. Thanks, Roddy.
Hiya, Simon.
Hello.
Is there any item you'd recommend taking or not taking when you're travelling in a tropical climate?
I'd recommend taking a mozzie net because I've had bad experiences otherwise because I was a bit of a fool and wasn't taking the tablets. Personally, I like the natural insect sprays. I've found they work quite well for me, but everybody's different. What would I recommend? If you're going budget, I was listening to somebody saying a great tip yesterday is buy your bag in a charity store rather than taking some sort of Gucci luggage as you walk around Nairobi. Be sensible. Take a torch or several, because two is one and one is none is a bit of a rule in serious tropic travel. Realise that places are... they're not like wandering around Slough, but that doesn't mean they have to be terrifying. You're human. We've proliferated on this planet because we're adaptable and we can survive and exist in tough places. Don't be frightened of strange places. The world is warm, it is welcoming, it is safe. Don't eat the salad at the posh hotel buffet because you're more likely to get sick from that. Wear a seatbelt, for goodness sake. I say this over and over again, and still I see people not. But embrace the world out there because, you know, we are living at such a spectacular time for travel. If you travel with your eyes open, sensibly, adventurously, exotically, you will have experiences now that nobody could ever imagine before.
Whew. You're also a big fan of a reusable water bottle.
I am. I just lost mine in Colombia. I just put the order. I've just had to buy another one yesterday. That's an absolutely vital bit of kit. I don't know if they're still here, but you know,
over there
you go. Personal filtration systems, water to go. Leave here, head over for the usual commission. but you know, those water bottles, you shouldn't be buying hundreds of litres of water that's been held in plastic bottles and has been cooked inside those plastic bottles for ages where you go. Take one of those and you save money, it's better for you and the planet, you know.
Yeah, another question. Roddy, thanks.
Just wanted to ask you, you mentioned about writing and your background in travel writing. Do you have any favourite travel writers that you would recommend?
How long have we got?
No, I like travel writing. I find it obviously is... there's a lot of clichés in travel writing, and I've no doubt put several of them into... Probably the only real travel-y book I've written. I wrote one book about travelling around the Tropic of Capricorn. I actually came to telly through writing books on terrorism, so rather different. But I have always loved travel as an idea. It was never a reality for me when I was young. But the great man, Michael Palin, was... an inspiration for me when I started out and when I was a kid. And I think what was brilliant about his journeys was he didn't make it seem like it was something utterly extraordinary that only incredible people could do, which I think is a fault of a lot of travel writing. He made it natural and human, and he made the people he met natural and human as well, not alien beings with strange, funny food and strange, funny cultures. So I think anybody who does that is all right in my book. I love Bill Bryson's book. I remember when I travelled around Australia, I realised I had, with a highlighter, marked up a lot of Bill Bryson's book for inspiration, but for information as well. He feeds a lot of knowledge and stories into his books, while also talking about how he's a sort of lumbering mess of a bloke who falls asleep in the back of a vehicle and drools down, is woken up drooling in the back of a taxi. You know, and I can personally equate to that as well. So I like, I like travel writing that's not pompous and pretentious. And Rory Stewart did a good thing in one of his books, where at the start of it, in his book, I think, where he walked across Afghanistan, he quoted lines from a number of books that had been written about Afghanistan beforehand, where they all talked, I think, about a sort of traffic policeman in Herat. And he made the point that back to the 1920s, successive writers had talked about this. They were all recycling the same story. So be aware and be wary of that. And don't take it too seriously, because as we know, travel is fun as well as stimulating, as well as intellectually stimulating. Sorry.
Can I chip in my two pennies worth on that as well, having just read 100 travel books for a review? Anything by this man is always worth reading. But can I also flag up anything by Horatio Clare, who is a genius writer? And my new discovery is a man called Malachy Talak, who's written a brilliant book called 60 Degrees North. I highly recommend that to you. It's really good. Some people are very good at doing sense of place. He's very good at doing.
I read one book that really has lingered, because I love reading a book about the country I'm going to. For understanding a country, I have never read a better book than In Spite of the Gods, which was written about India. And how can you possibly understand something the size, complexity, sophistication of India in one book? But that book comes fairly close to it. It's brilliant. In Spite of the Gods.
One last question to you from me. Is there anywhere you haven't been to yet that you've developed a burning desire to go to?
A burning desire? Yeah, I'm careful about burning desires because I feel very blessed as it is. I would say mild itch that I want to scratch would be Japan.
You've not done Japan? You've not been to Japan?
I haven't done Japan.
Done Japan.
How unfortunate I am.
Very appalling.
I've never been called to Japan.
Right.
But also for me, you know, my gig has been generally journeys that sound exotically appealing, but to work in darkness and problems as well. So Indian Ocean is a sort of, or Caribbean is a great example, because it sounds appealing when it's on telly on a Sunday night, and all the, not you, but all the other fickle TV viewers are lured by Downton or something like that. You know, I've traded on brands, if you like the Caribbean, Australia, obviously Indian Ocean. This is designed to get people watching. So Japan, I mean, I think it would probably work, but There are problems in Japan, of course, but it's a little bit too developed and safe in many ways, I think. You always look at your watch and that's such a clear... Could you do something a little less obvious than doing this to me?
I've been told we've got to wrap up. I'm getting words in my ear, unfortunately.
Thank you very much for coming. Do enjoy
the show. Do go and have a look at Stanford's bookshop over there to pick up your books. And water to go. But do go and see Simon over there, who will be signing books at the Stanford signing tent over there. And do you know the quickest way to stand on top of Everest? You go to Stanford's store in Covent Garden, you walk the 24 steps up to the first floor, and there is a map of the Himalayas on the floor. It's the easiest way to do it. You can stand on Everest in central London. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, Simon Reeve.
Thank you very much. Thank you.